Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. Last time we looked at the world of a young first lady who boasted a lot of firsts with her youth, style, ideas about women, and her time in the White House. This time we will look at another first lady who had bucked convention a bit before she became first lady to a sitting president. Julia Gardner, who was the only first lady younger and with a larger age gap from the president than Frances at 29 years, actually had a split of 30 years. She wasn't swept off her feet at first, but came around after some courtly romancing by the president and a tragedy. First, a little about The Bachelor. President John Tyler was born in 1790 and had been happily married to Letitia for 29 years, with whom he had 8 children. When she died of a stroke, she was the youngest first lady at the age of her death. She had suffered a stroke several years prior, so when she suffered another stroke on September 10th, 1842, it was probably no surprise. She was one of only 3 first ladies to die while serving as first lady, with the others being Caroline Harrison and Ellen Wilson. Apparently, John Tyler had been very loving to Letitia, but very reserved during their 5-year courtship, only kissing her on the hand 3 weeks before their actual marriage. However, as a widower, he was a bit more persistent when attempting to woo young Miss Gardner. Julia Gardner was born in 1820 on Gardner's Island to David Gardner and Juliana McLaughlin, who were an attorney, New York State senator, and the daughter of a wealthy landowner, respectively. Gardner's Island was a large, privately owned island right off of Long Island. There are all sorts of rumors about the history of the island, to include it actually being a site of a 1699 treasure burial by Captain Kidd. We do know that the island was invaded during the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, so apparently it must have been large enough to warrant ships stopping on the shores of the island for a spot of tea, whether by invitation or by force. The date of Julia's birth is most often reported as May 4th. However, there are some family records that indicate it could also have been July 23rd. She was the 3rd of 4 children. We do not know much about her early education, but most sources suspect she was tutored at home before she attended the Madame N. D. Chagre Institute for Young Ladies from April of 1835 to December of 1837, and if I've mispronounced that, I apologize, during which time Julia was about to make her debut into society. Also during this time, Julia made a name for herself in several ways. In 1839, Julia was pictured in an engraving on the arm of a young man posing with a handbag in front of a store called Bogart and McCamley's, number 86, 9th Avenue. And in the advertising style of the day, Julia is quoted as saying she will shop there because, quote, goods are beautiful and astonishingly cheap, end quote. This was scandalous. Not only was a single young lady on the arm of man in a lithograph that was widely distributed, but a young lady of society was endorsing one particular store in an advertisement. This was a young woman moving into the public sphere with her endorsement, which, of course, flew in the face of the cult of domesticity. Though her name was not used, the rose next to the term, quote, Rose of New York, end quote, made it clear who she was, apparently. When the scandal broke, Julia's parents had to do something, so they went to Washington, D.C. and presented their daughter in front of President Van Buren. Soon after, Julia and her sister went on a grand tour of Europe, which was common for the young ladies of Europe, and as we know, parents of well-born American girls were wont to emulate Europeans to make their girls seem more marketable for marriage. Apparently, there were also some titled men in Europe that fancied Julia, but they obviously came to nothing. Julia was presented in front of some titled nobility in Europe, to include the Pope, whose ring she kissed. Though her family was Protestant, this was considered quite the triumph of society. So the work was done to rebuild Julia's reputation, and the family returned to the States in September of 1841 and decided to move to D.C. for the season during January and February of 1842. Which included being invited to a White House reception. During this time, the first Mrs. Tyler was bedridden, and a daughter and daughter-in-law were acting as hostesses. So here's where the story gets tricky. Letitia Tyler dies in September of 1842. Julia is at the White House for a reception on January 20th, 1842, when she was 21. So if you ask yourself, did President Tyler know his soon-to-be young bride when his wife of many years was still alive? The answer to that question would be yes. Now, there's no evidence there were any shenanigans going on between the two of them then. However, it didn't take very long after Letitia died for Bachelor John to propose. On February 22nd, 1843, Tyler made his first attempt at winning the hand of Julia. He was refused, or some sources say at least held off. Julia was not as smitten with him as he was with her. The story, as told by Julia, is that when Tyler proposed marriage at Washington's birthday ball, where Julia was dressed as a Greek goddess, she answered, quote, "I had never thought of love," end quote. Julia later said, quote, "So I said, no, 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 and shook my head with each word, which flung the tassel of my Greek cap into his face with every move," end quote. When Julia told her mother about the president's interest in her, Mrs. Gardiner quickly took Julia back to New York. Yet Tyler persisted. Over a year, he waited patiently and stayed attentive to Julia. There was apparently some warm correspondence, but when her family took a trip to Europe at the end of 1843, that would indicate that there was not an impending wedding. Usually the family wouldn't be taking her back on another tour if they weren't still putting her out into the marriage market. Then a catastrophic event changed the nature of their relationship. Sometimes the dramatic scene needed to create the romantic interlude presents itself in an odd way. The family had again come to D.C. for the season when part of the Gardiner family had a fateful afternoon outing in February of 1844. The USS Princeton, designed by a man named John Erickson, had a new type of cannon called the Peacemaker. The captain wanted to show off the weapon and had a group of the social elite, including the president, members of the cabinet, and Julia's family, among many of the ladies and gentlemen of Washington, aboard for a trip down the Potomac to show off the ship, but Erickson was concerned that it was not ready, and he was correct. The first two firings went off without a hitch. The third, however, was different. The Secretary of War had asked for a third firing towards Mount Vernon. The captain thought it was a bad idea, but acquiesced to his superior. While most historical sources really only talk about three people dying, there were actually six deaths when the cannon exploded, and 20 more were injured. So here's the list of deaths. Armistead, the slave and personal valet of the president, David Gardner, Julia's father, Secretary of the Navy Thomas Gilmer, Beverly Kennan, who was the Navy's chief of construction, Virgil Maxey, who was basically kind of an American attaché of affairs to Belgium, and then Secretary of State Abel Upshur. So that's quite a few very important people. Needless to say, the death of her father overwhelmed Julia, who fainted into the arms of the president when she heard. Over the next few months, they wrote back and forth, and the president offered Julia comfort in her grief. Julia lost interest in any younger suitors, and by the time her father's remains were returned to East Hampton, Julia had already agreed to marry the president. Now, this was not the palatial affair one might expect of the president and from the bride who was willing to cause scandal, not only with her public ad, but one that later insisted Hail to the Chief be played whenever Tyler entered an official event, which is a still existing tradition today. But the president, who was now 54, and Julia, who had just turned 24, married quietly in a small ceremony on June 26, 1844, if we're going with the May birthday, and with only 12 guests at the Church of the Ascension. The president's son, John, was there, but I really didn't find any information about the other president's children for that day. The family basically said that their period of mourning dictated the quiet affair, meaning Julia's family, and I would agree a lavish ceremony would have been really tacky. But the craziest piece of information in my book was what the couple did after their wedding breakfast in the Gardiner home following the wedding. So, one of my daughters is actually getting married in a few months, and because I am a lover of history, I decided to diverge from the topic here to talk a bit about a question that often comes up when we discuss weddings of the 18th, 19th, and beginning of the 20th centuries, the wedding breakfast. I was watching an episode of Four Weddings with my girls, and one of the brides had an early wedding followed by a breakfast. The other brides, who of course were ignorant of tradition, basically said she was nuts and breaking with tradition. Well, that isn't true, of course. Most of our wedding traditions come from Western Europe and many from both Catholic and Anglican traditions that developed when the churches split, but the Church of England was borrowing from a lot of what had been Catholic traditions previously. A wedding used to be held during a mass or church service before which the couple would fast. Church services were held in the morning, and many of the traditional services, traditional churches now, of course, still have a mass every morning. Then, after the mass, a breakfast, which would be the couple's first symbolic meal together, would be hosted, often by a member of the bride's family. Now, there were other traditions before this, like the groom's party or bachelor party, that was actually held way back in the day when often brides were taken from their homes without consent, dark ages kind of stuff, or when marriages were all arranged and the groom had paid for his prize, but this wedding breakfast tradition came from a much more civilized period in history. I have to tell you, this is a tradition I would love to see reappear, not because of my own daughter's wedding, but because it would definitely keep the wedding industry on its proverbial toes. But back to our story. So, we return to the crazy event post-wedding. The couple actually went on a ferry boat cruise accompanied by naval salutes. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know if I would have been all that excited to get on a boat after the USS Princeton, and I definitely wouldn't have been stoked about naval salutes, which would have involved a cannon firing. But regardless, the couple disembarked in New Jersey when they took a train to Philadelphia. Just like Frances Folsom would be later, Julia Gardner was an object of fascination. Thousands of people turned out to catch a glimpse of her at every stop on the way to Washington, where a reception was held on June 28th in the Blue Room of the White House. On July 4th, the couple went to Old Point Comfort at Fort Monroe, where a cottage had been prepared for a honeymoon. So this is the one presidential marriage we talked about earlier that had a greater age difference than Frances Folsom and Grover Cleveland. While the public is fascinated, many people were also critical. Tyler's children by his first marriage were not all on board. The Gardners had already had a cordial relationship with a couple of Tyler's sons, but Letitia Tyler was never happy about the marriage, and the oldest daughter, Mary, was actually 5 years older than Julia, so you can just imagine how awkward that was. Then there wasn't much time between the Tyler wedding and Tyler leaving office. They were married in June of 1844, and his term was over in March of 1845. But in her short tenure, Julia had a couple of firsts. Some historians believe that Dolly Madison, with whom young Julia was acquainted before becoming First Lady, who now lived across Lafayette Square from the White House, had a great deal of influence over this new First Lady. Julia believed she should be a larger-than-life hostess and actually sought out newspaper coverage. She was the first lady to sit for a photograph, but while that was not mass-produced and sold, an engraving of her was. Just like the girl who had posed for the advertisement, Julia had no intention as First Lady of being a wallflower. She rode in a carriage with 8 matching Arabian horses and had 12 maids of honor with her, all dressed alike, funded by her wealthy family. Julia, whose husband had previously been convinced that dancing was immoral, not only became the first lady to dance at a White House function, but also managed to convince Tyler that it was not, in fact, immoral and hosted a grand finale ball with 3,000 guests. You really cannot make this stuff up, and we are definitely seeing the reason the Tylers suffered from extreme money difficulties later in life. But Julia actually sat on a platform with her maids of honor, apparently wearing a peacock feather headdress during this ball, and received the formally announced guests. However, she did a favor for first couples and guests to come because after that, a ball was an acceptable event at the White House. The social season would have only been from December to March, so her time to make these changes was brief. One change Julia made that actually made sense and contributed to security, which also speaks to the later changes in security made by Francis Cleveland, was to have the president stand against the wall on one end of the Blue Room instead of standing in the middle, where any president would be mobbed by crowds. She received all sorts of requests for pardons, military leave, and federal jobs, which she would pass along to the appropriate agency and then give her opinion on the matter. Apparently, she also worked as an intermediary between the president and her brother Alex, who was attempting to start a new party with Tyler as the presidential candidate by controlling all the federal appointments in Suffolk County, New York. This did not work, but Julia was definitely willing to get down and dirty with the politics. She also encouraged the annexation of Texas, one of Tyler's main goals, such that the quote was, quote, "Texas was the captain's bride till a lovelier one he took," end quote. And when he signed the joint resolution for annexation, he gave the pen to Julia, who wore it on a chain around her neck. So in 1845, they leave the White House and retire to Sherwood Forest, which is a plantation on the banks of the Charles River in Virginia. Interestingly, Sherwood Forest had been owned during the time of Tyler's birth by William Henry Harrison. Harrison never lived there, and it was owned by another party between that time and Tyler purchasing the property, but it is interesting that it was owned independently by two presidents. Tyler had 8 children by his first wife, with 7 of those surviving infancy, and then 7 more by Julia, which puts him at the record of the most legitimate children fathered by an American president. However, Tyler has also been named as the father of a child named Dungy with a slave, though I couldn't find much information on this story. This is interesting to me because Cleveland, one of our other presidents who liked his ladies young, had an illegitimate child, as we heard in our last episode. Could there be a pattern here? Of course, many men in this era had children all over the place, but these two men do seem to share some traits. The Tylers stayed away from Washington until 1861, when Tyler was chairman of the Virginia Peace Commission, attempting to avoid a civil war, but when that did not succeed, believed secession was the only option. The Tylers were loyal to the Confederacy, and Tyler was elected to the House of Representatives for the Confederate Congress. He never took his seat because he became ill soon after leaving for Richmond. John Tyler died on January 18, 1862, and was honored as a hero of the Confederacy. Jefferson Davis attended the funeral, and the coffin was draped in a Confederate flag. They had lived lavishly, and John Tyler did not leave Julia in a good financial position. Julia feared retaliation for her views on slavery, so she put all of the family papers in a bank in Richmond for safekeeping, which turned out to be a poor choice because the bank was destroyed during the war, and the collection was destroyed with it. Julia was sometimes allowed to pass through the Union lines, and when the battles made it dangerous for Julia to remain at Sherwood Forest, which was largely destroyed during the war, she went to live on Staten Island in the Gardner Tyler House, which had belonged to her mother. Julia Tyler attempted to get federal reimbursement for the destroyed plantation, but did not succeed. She volunteered for the Confederacy even while living in New York, which caused strain with her family, and when the South was defeated, she lost much of her other means of income and struggled financially until she later began to receive the pension given to widowed first ladies by Congress. Julia did eventually move back to Virginia. One of the subjects that persisted after leaving the White House and all of her life was the strained relationship with her stepchildren. John Tyler had told his three oldest daughters just weeks before the wedding that he had no intention of remarrying. And as we said before, Letitia Tyler Semple never accepted Julia. There had been a story in the New York Morning News in 1846 that Julia and John were divorcing, but it was actually Tyler's son John Jr.'s marriage that was in trouble. After this incident, Julia became almost obsessed in trying to protect their public image, even writing a response to an English duchess and other noble ladies who signed a plea to all American women to work for the abolition of slavery. Julia did not defend slavery, but tried to debunk what she said were myths about slavery, but mostly as she asserted that the English had no say over American policies. She certainly changed no minds, but she attempted nonetheless. The sale of another family property saved them having to sell Sherwood Forest by a bankruptcy court, and her oldest son, David Guardy Gardner Tyler, was the owner and operator by this time. Julia converted to Catholicism and wanted to be an example for Catholic women in a largely Protestant country. Clearly, she believed herself to be a trendsetter, though she spent such a short time in the spotlight. Julia had been acquainted with William Evarts, who was the Secretary of State under President Hayes, and managed to get two of her son's federal jobs. She also worked to get the widow's pension. When Mary Lincoln received one, Julia believed she would as well, but not everyone was psyched about giving money to a former Confederate, and was then given $1,200 a year versus the $3,000 received by Mrs. Lincoln. However, after President Garfield was assassinated later that year, all of the living presidential widows were given the same $5,000 a year. And then anonymously, Julia wrote a letter to the Washington Post suggesting it should be $10,000. Now, whether or not it should have been raised to $10,000 a year, Julia was definitely always looking for an increase in income, and I have to say, in an attempt to be generous, was a little clueless about how she came across to the world. Julia was raised to believe slavery was not morally wrong, which was an idea that was less prevalent in New York during her youth than it would have been in Virginia, where she spent her later years. Though historians do not really speak of this, she does seem to have been spoiled, and though she was willing to break with the very strict New York social codes in some things, truly believed all people of good society should present themselves in a certain way, even if that meant going into debt to keep up that public image. Now, if this had any bearing on her decision to accept John Tyler's advances after turning them down repeatedly, I suppose a cynical person might, you know, say she was not a kind person and definitely didn't understand how she came across. I think, however, after some reflection, more of an emptiness in Julia's life, followed by a great deal of support by a besotted old widower who apparently had a lot of self-confidence, led to her decision. He was not the Colonel Brandon of the story, who adored Marianne, yet believed her to be out of his league. I would certainly say John Tyler wasn't worried about how this relationship would appear to the outside world, or better yet, to his children. Yet they endured. They were married until the former president's death, and Julia persisted with his memory until her own death in 1889. She was 69 years old, and coincidentally, suffered from a stroke. Julia was buried next to her husband in Richmond. For spending such a short time as First Lady, she certainly caused a lasting stir and had continued to go to Washington for the social season until 1887. So I would say Julia's greatest influence over the office of First Lady was to give permission for First Ladies to consider their position as much a social one as that of a public servant. Was this a good thing? I don't really know, but it certainly makes for a great story. That concludes our History's Hotties for today. Today I have to share that I'm going to finish out the three-part series on marrying an American president and then suspend the podcast for a while. We are moving to another duty station, and I am not going to be able to continue while we are there. I really enjoy doing the podcast, but adequately researching the history takes a lot of time. So I am going to attempt to put an MP3 of each episode on the Facebook page, which I will keep open. So if you have any questions or comments, you may find our Facebook page, History's Hotties, or email me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com, no apostrophe. So until next time.